Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Danny Lyon. He is a photographer, filmmaker, and writer, and he has so many books out that are stacked right next to me on the table right now. A great deal of history from the civil rights movement through the present. Welcome, Danny, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me here, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you, and it's been a real treat for me to be exposed to your work. You come from a New York family. You grew up in Queens, and your father was an amateur photographer. How did you start doing photography?
When I was 17, I graduated from high school, and I was going to on my way to the University of Chicago. And I spent the summer in Europe with my older brother, who could drive. And my father said, you know, you're going to be in Munich, get a German camera. And I bought something called an EXA, which was a single-lens reflex, really simple, because a reflex requires a prism to reverse the image, which is reversed by the mirror. This didn't have one, so everything was backwards and upside down. That was my first camera, but it was a serious camera.
And then you went to the University of Chicago, and you very quickly got involved with taking pictures of the emerging civil rights movement.
Well, that actually took 3 years. So I entered school in 1959. You know, I had lived through McCarthyism, and things were quiet. And at that period in America, like, nothing was happening. And I remember there were stories about Japanese students fighting over the airport, and there were huge physical fights between thousands of demonstrators, and nothing like that was happening in America. So the 60s begins with a kind of brain-dead America. There's nothing happening. And the 50s are really a very boring time,
except
politically.
That Martin Luther King was
busy. Nobody knew about Martin Luther King in 1959. I mean, I wasn't black, and none of the mainstream media covered the civil rights movement. It didn't exist. You know, there really was a white world or a black world, and there were black publications. No white people ever read them. You know, Seymour Hersh said something. He was referring to My Lie, but he said in some of his writings, if there's a social revolution in America, it takes 2 years for the media to discover it. And that timing was just about perfect, you know. So I entered school in 59-60. In the summer of, you know, and like marijuana is just kind of coming onto the campus. In fact, I still have a letter saying that I was put on academic probation and they expelled a student. So, and they couldn't even say the word marijuana in the letter. I mean, I'm just trying to set this. You know, it's revisionism is when we take our world and put it on the past. But I was alive then, and I'm a documentarian, so I keep all this stuff. And photographs are also records. I ended up, if I had a specialty, it was history, so I'm not a trained historian, but I'm like reading all this ancient history, medieval history. And I see the camera as an instrument of history, which to me was just common sense. But, you know, one of the really well-known photographers was Matthew Brady. I mean, that was something like a high school kid might know. Oh, Matthew Brady was a photographer. He was called a historian with a camera.
Yeah.
Photography was not considered an art. No museum collected it. Only two museums collected it. Nobody cared about it. Photographs were worthless. In fact, I would sell my first print in a new dorm. So this would be near my freshman year for $2, and I never got paid. It's probably worth $12,000 now. But and even like going forward now to like, I think it's like 1968, 69. Where I've already, by then, I've done all the work that would make me famous. The Museum of Modern Art buys 10 prints from me, and they offer me $25 a piece. And I say, how about $35? And they say I'm like a megalomaniac, a priest.
Right.
You know, one of those really went, The same print, meaning made at the same time at the Whitney, recently went for $30,000 to the Whitney.
Very interesting.
So photography is nowhere. It's just not an art.
At that time.
It has zero value, and for collectors, they had none exist. Nor does the civil rights movement exist. So I kind of became the campus photographer. I was interested in photography.
And you met a man named Hugh Edwards.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, to this day, back then and to this day, you know, photography was really kind of controlled by the Museum of Modern Art. Meaning, if people who were, like, friendly, as in having lunch with and socializing with and literally being friendly with, John Zarkovsky got elevated. And people who didn't do that didn't exist. I mean, it's still one of the issues about media and New York. I'm a New Yorker and I love New York. But as Noam Chomsky's pointed out, it's the big media in New York and in the big urban centers that has absolutely no freedom in it. It's the little media like you that no one really cares about that's so free and wonderful. So right now in New Mexico, you're getting really excellent coverage of Occupy from Alibi, from the Journal of all places, from local radio. It's been fabulous. They're practically announcing the demonstrations. National media is a whole other animal, and that's the one that's going to have to fall, and maybe it's crumbling as we speak. But so I'm a New Yorker, and the Art Institute of Chicago was one of the two institutions that actually collected photographs and treated it as an art form. I think the other was George Eastman House. And when Stieglitz died, I think Stieglitz dies in 1947 in New York. And he lived with George O'Keefe in various apartments. And they were within a few blocks of my father's office. My father was an immigrant, German immigrant, but he was an ophthalmologist. I mean, he was an eye surgeon, but he examined eyes. And Stieglitz was a patient of his. I mean, I was not aware of this because I was 5 years old. But nevertheless, it's true. And when Stieglitz dies, O'Keefe takes his photographs, makes two piles, give one to the Art Institute of Chicago and one to the Met. So the Met at that point starts collecting photographs.
Now, Hugh Edwards was an expert and a curator of photographs,
right,
and became your friend and looked at your work and encouraged you, and
right,
in one of your books you include a conversation with him that
right,
you were able to preserve on tape. Who was he, and how did he influence you?
He was an amazing man, and he I think he was like a father figure to me. I think he was an intellectual, but I thought he was an intellectual father. I meet Edwards when I'm about 18 years old, and he's I'm a kid. I'm on campus, and the university has an arts festival. It's called the Festival of the Arts, and I hang up a couple prints, and he's the judge, and he's famous because he's the curator at the Art Institute of Chicago. Having a show there is considered awesome, which it still is, and he has the power to do it. So I know who he is, and he happens to be crippled, meaning he walks on wooden crutches. He wears a little Congo cap. He's about 5'4". He's from Paducah, Kentucky. He's self-educated. He's just an absolutely brilliant intellectual, self-taught, meaning he reads books in 4 or 5 different languages, all of which he's taught himself. He also loves young people. He buys every new novel that's published written by a man, so he has no money because he'll just buy anything anybody publishes. His house is full of books. So I meet him, and he changed my life. I mean, he gave me a prize, he befriended me, and I would go and sit at his feet and listen to him, and I still can remember the things he said.
There's an interesting part where I think that you talk with him about the problem of people who try to make art convey a political ideology.
Right.
And there you were, a very idealistic person who wanted to go out and change the world, as many did at that time and still do. and try to make things better. And there was a lot of contemplation about what the role of photography is in that.
So I meet Edwards, and he gives me an award for taking a picture of a truck in the desert. It's like my first photograph, and it appears. It's been published. It's a good picture. And I had started photographing motorcycles because I was a bike rider.
Right.
I had a Triumph. My friends were riding Triumphs and BSAs. And when our class left, they put up a wooden sign in the middle of campus saying no motorcycle riding allowed on the quad, because there's a big circle and we would do wheelies and go around. And one of my friends claims he went up the steps and through the administration building and out the other side. So this was the University of Chicago in 1962 with a group of people riding motorcycles. Anyway, that gets interrupted, and I joined the civil rights movement and spent a year doing it. And when I show him those pictures, this guy's from Paducah, Kentucky, whose great uncle was shot in the head at Shiloh, fighting for the North, because Kentucky was a slave state that fought, was divided. Said, he looked at these pictures, he said, what are they trying to do, start the Civil War all over again? So that was never a favorite part of the photographs that I took. But other pictures that I took, he would show at the Art Institute, and he did it twice. So, you know, this is unheard of today. I've never had a one-man show at MoMA, for instance. If I have, no one told me about it. So this was really amazing. You know, I think I was, when I had the first one, I was 25 years old, and I was 27 when I had the second one. This is unbelievable, really. These are one-man exhibits. But that, you know, I in the writing in this book, I try to nail him down as to how he decides. And he says, in looking at photographs, he said, anything that makes me feel good and glad to be alive, I like. So here's a guy who has the courage of his convictions, who never does anything that's popular, who never does anything anyone else wants, who simply goes by his own instincts. That's so rare in editing, publishing, curating, sticking your neck out. Nobody does it. They're all looking over their shoulder, they're bean counting, they're saying, is this popular, is this going to be a hit? He was a guy who, he couldn't have cared less about that stuff. He was the first person to show Robert Frank in America. He gave him a one-man show. He gave me 2 one-man shows, and he did it for lots and lots of young people.
We're talking to photographer Danny Lyon. So tell us about your time in the civil rights movement. I mean, you got involved as a photographer, and I didn't realize that some of these iconic images, which I had seen before, were in fact yours, but photography played a really major role. That's interesting, because somewhere in, I've been reading all these texts that you've written, so I can't remember where it was, but somewhere you say, I like to tell the stories in text as well as show the photographs, because photographs can't tell stories by themselves, but some of them really can. I mean, some of these photographs from the civil rights movement, in a frame, you have an entire story, for example, of police brutality.
If I had been killed when I was 23, the civil rights photographs I took when I was 20 and 21 would have ensured me a place in the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
Even though Edwards didn't like them, the civil rights movement has risen and risen and risen and risen higher and higher in the esteem of Americans and the world. It was not always that case. It's very important to understand that the civil rights movement was not popular. It's very important to understand that what the civil rights movement was doing often was illegal. That's why they arrested them. It was illegal to sit in at certain places. It was illegal to sit down the street in Atlanta. Sometimes it was illegal to picket places. The federal government came down, the federal government, not the state of Georgia, but the feds came down with a serious lawsuit against SNCC saying that marching back and forth in front of a store saying boycott this place was some kind of a violation of fair trade, and hit civil rights workers with really serious federal sentences that slowed things up for years in Georgia. My mother, bless her, who was a way to the left liberal, Russian liberal, you know, who worked her ass off for Adlai Stevenson, said, but what they're doing is illegal. So this was not a popular thing. This was an unpopular thing. I mention Occupy because there's so many similar things, you know, that they're now saying in New York while they're urinating in the street or someone is fucking in a sleeping bag. I mean, these are classic things that were always said about the demonstrators, you know, in the civil rights movement. It's only later in history, after the civil rights movement has these huge successes and martyrs, it's a generation later that the media starts churning out films and putting it in books, and everyone says how wonderful it was, as if they were all there, but they weren't all there, you know.
And you were there, and you were in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and one of the few white people, you eventually became the staff photographer. What were your relationships like, and what was your life like doing this? I mean, obviously, you and everybody else was in danger quite a bit of the time, and as you write in your books, they sought out the most dangerous places and situations because they thought if they could make change there, they could do it anywhere.
Right. It was really a brilliant idea. You know, in other words, how do 50 people change a nation of 150 million? Because SNCC started with 60 people. When I joined SNCC as a paid staff member, it had 60 staff members. You know, the year before it had 20. How did 20 people change the world? And, you know, there's a line in Taylor Branch talking about this moment in history. Actually, he's talking about 18 months before I joined. The sit-in movement itself had started spontaneously. I mean, a number of people over the ages had tried to be served illegally and sat in a little business bus. But when these four students did it at Raleigh, I think April the 1st, 1960, it set off a wave and everybody started doing it, the black kids in the South. And that was the beginning of the civil rights movement, my civil rights movement. And King, who was older, met with the SCLC and said, we got to control this. We got to create an organization for the kids that we can control. And at the, you know, I was marveling at how many women are in Occupy. It's mostly women. I mean, it's a majority is women. I marched on Saturday. I've been down in Albuquerque 5 or 6 times. Most of them are. I mean, if you would actually count them, you'd get 65% women. There are no women working with King. There's one woman, Ella Baker. And they say, Ella, you do that. That's your job. Make these kids form an organization so we can control it. So Ella Baker called a conference in New Rust University. The 50th anniversary of that was last April, and I went to it, and Julian Bond was there, and John Lewis was there, and Harry Belafonte was there. And I went up to Harry Belafonte, and I thanked him for putting up $300 that sent me on one of my trips down south. And here's this old guy, and he immediately hustled me for a free book, and I was so impressed that he was still a hustler, because inside every artist is a hustler, from the days when that's how they survived. So anyway, Ella calls this conference. All these people show up, including a lot of white people from the North. And Ella said, you have an organization that you control it. And she really, and so she's a revered figure. But what Taylor Brand said was the greatest minds of a black generation had come together. Yeah. John Lewis, Julian Bond, Diane Nash, James Forman. These were brilliant people. There were lots of them. They planned it all, and they carried it out. And Bob Moses, who came, was a New York school teacher, math teacher. He quits. They come together. They say, if we're going to do this with this little group, we're going to go into worse places. We're going to die. And when they see us die, they're going to pay attention. And when they see us succeed, if we can succeed in Southwest Georgia, in the Mississippi Delta, then we can change this whole country. And ultimately, because I was really like a son to Foreman, they wanted to change the voting in Congress because the worst congressmen at the time were from these black belt states where the blacks couldn't vote, you know.
And so what did that actually look like? Like, give us some examples of places they went, what they did. Places you went, because you were there.
So I'm a student at the University of Chicago, and basically the student photographer. And I was riding my motorcycle, and my motorcycle broke, and I couldn't fix it, and I screwed up the heads. And it took weeks to repair it, and I was just bored. And a girl I knew had been arrested. So, again, I didn't really have any connection, didn't know anything, and there was nothing in the media. And her name was Linda Perlstein, and she was a student at the University of Chicago. And I went to Linda, and she said I was arrested in Cairo, Illinois, which is 350 miles south, which is a town in Huckleberry Finn that they're trying to get to coming down the Mississippi because they miss it in the night. And it's still there, and it's at the very tip of Illinois, on where I think Ohio runs into Mississippi. And he says, she gives me names, and I hitchhike down there. And that's the beginning for me. I take a camera. I thought I'm taking advantage of these people. They're going to give me a place to stay. I have no place to stay, and it's an adventure. And I was looking at the pictures last night for other reasons, because I'm about to go back to Georgia. And the very first picture of the very first roll, and this is bulk-loaded film you can buy for a dollar and load it yourself and put it in the cassettes and develop. And it's a little fogged, and it's a picture of a young black guy sitting in the corner. He's in a church, and he looks bored, and it's John Lewis.
Yeah.
And John Lewis would become my friend for life. But that's the first moment I see him. He had been a freedom rider. I knew who he was. It's infectious, you know. If you meet a hero, it makes you want to be heroic, you know. The civil rights movement was kind of like a disease, you know. You caught it. It was infectious. You know, I reached Georgia. I'm in these churches. I am Jewish. I don't go to churches. The place is exploding. I mean, these are wooden churches. The buildings are shaking from women are singing and clapping. And they're not really they're religious songs, but they've been turned into civil rights songs, you know. It's mesmerizing. You joined it. They used you. I meet James Foreman. He says he's head of SNCC. He became a real father figure to me. He died a few years ago. He said, you got a camera? I said, yeah. He says, meaning you're white, you got a camera. He says, go in that building, the courthouse. There's a big water cooler for white people. There's a little thing like for dogs. It says colored. Go take a picture of that. And then he says, like, it's illegal. I didn't know what he said, but I go in there. My heart is beating very hard because these policemen are nasty, real nasty. And there's no light. And I take this picture of it.
And there it is, white and colored drinking fountains. And it's such a metaphor for virtually everything that was going on at that time. We're talking to photographer Danny Lyon. By the way, the book is called Memories of the Southern Civil Rights Movement, and it's published by Twin Palms Publisher, which is right here in Santa Fe. They're on the plaza, and anybody can just go down and walk right in. But it's a marvelous book with a foreword by Julian Bond, which is very interesting, because he talks in his foreword about the promise of that movement and the unfulfillment of that promise. And one feels that from your descriptions and from the photographs of the tremendous power and brilliance in this movement. And one wonders what the legacy of that movement is today. How successful were they and were they not?
Well, I think what Julian wrote, he wrote about 15 years ago. He wrote it when Clinton was elected, because he said, gave a copy to Clinton, and Clinton wrote me a letter about the book. And John wrote the afterword. And John and Julian are both from Atlanta, and when they had to, because of gerrymandering, there are only a few districts that blacks can get elected in America. And so Julian Bond and John Lewis, two of the most brilliant people of their generation, were pitted against each other, and of course it destroyed their friendship, although I think they made up. John won, and he's been in Congress ever since. And they're very different people. Julian Bond is a very radical person. I'm a very radical person. So what was the civil rights movement about? was it about the right to have a hamburger? Was it about the, I mean, and how, what's the right to a hamburger if you can't afford a hamburger? Was born in Brooklyn, and, you know, 15 years ago, there was an article of the Times that said that blacks and whites in Brooklyn, and we're talking about millions of people, had reached income parity. It didn't make any difference. And it's a nice place to live. I got so excited because that's what the Civil Rights Movement is about. But the Voting Rights Act came out of the movement. Johnson passed it. And the effect of it. So I'm going to backtrack. So when 20-year-old kid me goes down to Georgia, blacks can't vote in 13 states. And I like to mention that Indians were not allowed to vote here in this state, I think, until the 1950s. Is that wrong? No, they couldn't buy liquor, I guess. There's a difference. I'm sorry. You're going to get a lot of phone calls on that. I think the Native Americans weren't allowed to buy alcohol until the 50s in this state. But anyway, that's unbelievable but true. So it's not any segregation of poll taxes, and black people don't vote in Mississippi, Georgia, the 12 deep south states. That all gets overturned. It affects everything in America. I grew up with what was called the Solid South, meaning all those states were Democratic because of the Civil War. I'm laughing because now they're all Republican.
I know.
Because of the Civil Rights Movement.
Right.
And the worst consequence was basically they said, okay, black people can vote now, we'll just put them in jail. And so I was making a film in Mississippi and talking to a guy who was fishing. And we started mentioning Parchment Penitentiary because he worked there. He was a young black guy. And he says, there's nothing but black folk up in that penitentiary, which means there's nothing but black folk in those penitentiaries. So there's this huge population of young black males who are locked up.
Which they're calling the new Jim Crow.
That's exactly what it is. So it's really sickening to think about this, you know. So that was America's answer to black people voting. Well, we'll just throw a lot of any uppity ones, we'll throw them in jail.
Tell us about just some of the things you lived through. One of the ones that I made note of was the Leesburg Stockade.
Those girls are like 65 now.
But right.
Well, it's a great story, and I'm about to go back to Georgia, so I've only met one or two of those girls since then. But so I show up in Atlanta, and I basically spent a year as a student going down to demonstrations and photographing and being involved and contributing to the movement. But as soon as I graduate, I don't wait for graduation. I get on a plane, go to Atlanta. I've been told I had a job. I end up in Danville in the hospital. Everybody's been beaten up. It's a horror scene. And I finally get to Atlanta, and someone says, oh, that's going to be your dark room. And they take me down the street, and there's like a lounge. It's really a bar. And in the back, there's a curtain, and there's a toilet, and a safe light.
That's your dark room.
And I'm horrified because I'd been using the dark room at the University of Chicago, which was as big as this cafe we're in. It was magnificent, you know. And that was the only dark room I'd ever been in. I ended up bringing my own stuff down, putting it in the SNCC office in the bathroom. Anyway, so I'm doing this stuff for SNCC and getting paid. I had a Southern Air credit travel card for an airline, and I got $35 a month or a week or whatever. It's a lot of money. And I'm on the staff, and then they have these semi-annual meetings. And many of the most powerful people in SNCC were at Howard University. Stokely Carmichael was one. The fellow Marion Barry, who became mayor of Washington, was another. Cortland Cox. These are powerful intellectuals. And they all show up, and they immediately go to Foreman and saying, who's it? And he says, this is Danny Lyon. He's our new photographer. And like Marion Barry says right in front of me, he says, what do we need him to take our pictures for? And I'm going like, you know, I mean, I'm this little white guy. I'm afraid of these guys, you know. I'm afraid of them every kind of way, you know. And And they're all looking at each other like, and I'm thinking, they don't want me here. What happened to my job? I moved here. And Foreman takes him into the bathroom and has a meeting. And I'm going, and I'm looking at this closed door, and I'm thinking, Jesus, my future is being decided in this bathroom. So I'd later talk to Julian about what did that mean? What do we need him to take our pictures for? Did it mean, what do we need a white guy to take our pictures for? Julian's take on it was, what do we need an outsider to take pictures for? What do we need a staff member to take pictures for? We can do it ourselves. That's a fair take on it. Because, you know, they didn't have the money.
And they didn't realize the power of art, basically the power of art, to move people. I mean, you talked in one of, I think it was this book, Memories of the Southern Civil Rights Movement, about how Life magazine and Look magazine were the most read magazines of that time, and you hated them, and you wanted to show a different reality. And that's, it seems like, what you were doing.
I was doing it. Foreman understood it. Foreman was a brilliant man. He was older. He hired Julian Bond out of journalism school. He looked up the best journalism schools in Atlanta, and he says, and he recruited him. He said, I want you to be in SNCC, you know. Julian was nominated for vice president of the United States when he was too young to be nominated for vice president. And he was an anti-war resistor. He's a brilliant man. And so Foreman understood my talent and me and really forced me on them. And so had that not happened, I don't think any of this would have happened. But he was right, and it was a happy marriage. You know, I had an inside seat to one of the great events of the century, if not all our history. And I'll be forever grateful for that.
And so just tell us quickly about the Leesburg story.
Oh, yeah. So there's this kind of atmosphere of, like, am I actually doing anything? Because the SNCC people, they were activists. They went to jail. If someone would say, oh, I think we ought to do such and such, they'd say, well, go ahead and do it. And they'd say, okay, and they'd go ahead and do it. In other words, these were not pass the buck people. There were no committees. It was a kind of anarchy. And they were amazingly effective, and it was their lives. You know, there were kids who dropped out of school to do this 24/7. And word came up to Atlanta from Georgia, and I think it's 200 miles away, that a lot of kids had been arrested and were in jail. And someone told me to go down there, probably Foreman. I don't remember if I had a car. I did have a car later, but this car was a shift car. So anyway, I end up down there, and I go down there, and you know, the only places blacks could function safely in the South were in churches and in drugstores and funeral parlors, which they owned. These were black-owned businesses. And this meeting was in, like, a funeral parlor, a druggist store. And a kid came, and I met a kid, and he said, well, they got him out in a compound, and there's 50 girls out there.
And they'd been demonstrating.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't really even know what... I think what happened was they had marched out of high school as a demonstration. They just marched out singing and stuff like that. And they basically Greg grabbed everyone and arrested him. Only they put him in a stockade on the edge of town, which was a cinder block house out in a field, and there were no facilities. I mean, there was no beds.
No beds, no blankets.
This was something out of South Africa.
No toilets, no sinks,
right,
nothing.
There were 11, I think as young as 11, 12, 13. They were high school kids, junior high school. So, you know, it's common to have arrests. These things actually were happening all over the South. That summer, 15,000 people were arrested. It was a high watermark of the Civil Rights Movement, the summer of 1963. And this was one of many. Most of these things are undocumented and not even known about.
That summer is the March on Washington.
That's later and kind of a big middle-class thing, and a lot of people come to that. But that isn't what I'm interested in or photographing. I mean,
right.
This is the real deal happening all over. This is deep southern states and no police protection, no press, no nothing. So I drive out. How did we do it? So there's a cinder block thing in a field. It was a shift car. He didn't know how to drive it. I was in the back seat lying. I wasn't in the back seat. I was in the well behind the seat, like, so you couldn't see me. And he drives up to this thing and parks. And he says there's a guard there, one old guard they call Pop. And he said, I'll go around and talk to him in the front.
And you went around the back.
Well, I waited, and then I get out, and there's a big cinder block, and I kind of crawl over to it. And there's just this big white cinder block building with bars on it and broken glass in the windows. And I go up to it, and immediately there are all these absolutely beautiful girls inside, kind of semi-dressed. And they look up at me, and I appear kind of like an angel at the window. It's just a stunning moment. And they all come, crowd around me, and they touch me. I put my hand through the window, and we're touching each other. They say freedom, and they're talking to me. And I couldn't take any pictures, because you can't take a picture when there's a crowd around you. And I said, I asked them, I said, I couldn't take any pictures because they were all in my face. I said, listen, I explained I was there to take pictures. They said, we'll pretend we're sleeping and do our things. So they moved away from me, got back on the ground. I took pictures through that window. I went around the back. You could see a single toilet completely buried in feces. The only source of water was a shower head that was dripping. I took a picture of that. This is all through the broken window. And then the best picture shows them all standing there. I mean, this whole thing probably took 10 minutes. And then I went crawl back in the car and got back in. The kid came back and he could hardly drive or go bouncing off. But when I went back to Atlanta, they developed the films and they sent it to a congressman. And the congressman, hundreds of congressmen, a supporter of SNCC, entered those photographs like the next day into the congressional record. And then the children were immediately released.
Right.
So I'd actually done something with a camera. And I think at that moment, the Marion Barrys and the other people like SNCC, Instagram, were so skeptical of me, accepted that I was one of them.
We're talking to photographer Danny Lyon. There's so much to talk about because you've done so much work besides this. I mean, this is work that you basically finished in 1964, and you go
50
on from there.
Years ago.
Yeah.
60. This was 60. That was 63. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you went on to make a lot of photographs and tell a lot of stories, and it's striking how many thieves, criminals, prostitutes, murderers, and people you have focused on in your life, and what drew you? I mean, you made a little film which I was just watching earlier called Murderers. What drew you to those people, prisoners in particular?
Yeah, I go from... I left SNCC, and leaving SNCC is kind of like leaving the Mayflower or the Kibbutz. You don't really leave SNCC, and I often later wondered why did I leave, but I become bored with it. Other photographers came down, and I wanted to move on, So I think I saw America as my subject, and the Civil Rights Movement was something that I got caught up in. It was just like Occupy. You get very caught up in these things. You can't say I'm going to do it next year because it's happening now. So I kind of went back to my life of motorcycles, and I did the Bike Riders. That's probably the most influential book I ever did, was the Bike Riders. So it's about motorcycle gangs. And then I went to Manhattan. I did the thing on architecture. But I had never been in a prison. I think I saw it as this America that didn't exist. I mean, that's what Occupy's about. This question of what do they want, it makes you want to laugh your head off like you're in an insane asylum. How can anyone ask this question, what do they want, I mean, people my age have been beating our heads against the cement for our entire lives, And look what they've done to this country. I mean, this is one of the greatest pieces of real estate on the planet. We have Alaska. Can you imagine if the Chinese had Alaska, what it would be like? I mean, we're fighting some gold mines and stuff. But, America is an incredible place, and the Americans are an incredible people. But what have they done to this, to us? What's happened to the Americans? So I always saw myself as trying to explode that myth and bring reality back into the media. You want to hear something funny? When I was a little boy, I thought I'd be with Walter Cronkite. Kind of like you would be on Fox News, and there wouldn't be the shit. It would actually be interesting, So that's what I dreamed of. But there's no way that someone with my personality, politics could ever integrate themselves into big-time media. Some of those books were self-published because no one would publish them. I still struggle to get my films out. This Murderous film, for instance.
Yeah.
I was talking to a reporter. He said, what's the release date? I mean, there isn't a release date because no one's ever is interested in it. But it's actually a very important film. So I think I saw prison as a dark and secret world, just like black people were a dark and secret world at one time. And I wanted to get inside it. And I loved that it was a forbidden world. It's the forbidden city.
How did you get inside?
That's one of the great coups of my life. And you know, I was asked that question in China, because I spent 6 years doing a book on China, which I hope we have time to talk about. And I had like 500 Chinese kids and a translator. And the first question is, how did I get inside this prison? And I thought, I better give them a simple answer because I got a translator. And I thought for a moment, and then I said, I lied. And there was silence. And then everybody started cheering and laughing and clapping, because that's what all the Chinese people do all the time. They just lie, because it's the only way they can survive in this totalitarian society. So, yeah, I lied. I said I loved their prison and would do an annual report and would have a historic thing they could be proud of. I mean, what am I supposed to tell? You know, it's public property. It's just like that park that the Schmedley is telling people they don't have a right to be in. It's, prisons are public. They're paid for by tax dollars. They shouldn't be secret worlds. Prisons are as much to keep us out. They're probably more to keep us out than to keep the people in. We got one right over the hill over there, brand new one. They're everywhere in New York. We got more prisons than anybody, practically.
Danny Lyon, we could do 10 hours and probably will at some point, but let's talk about your most recent book, which is Deep Sea Diver, an American photographer's journey into Shaanxi, China. How did this whole thing come about? I mean, it's interesting both in terms of content and in terms of what this is as a book, because what it looks like and the way it's laid out is your handwritten notes and photographs taped as if they were taped onto a page. That's what the format of the book is.
Well, I was invited to a festival in China 6 or 7 years ago. I didn't want to go, and they anyway, I just kept saying no, and then they flew me first class, and I ended up in China, and I went crazy. I loved it. I mean, I left the festival. I went out in the streets, and I couldn't believe I'd walk back into America 1930 or something. I mean, it looked like pre-Walker Evans. There was smoky trucks everywhere, lots of bicycles. People went in the wrong direction in the streets. I mean, there was a whorehouse on the fifth floor of the hotel I was in. It was endlessly fascinating. And it wasn't anything like the media tells us about China. I mean, all I've heard about China is they're beating us, competing, everything's new, they're going to make more money and all this, like they're the new enemy. So, I mean, I think my first ideological thought was to humanize them, because, I mean, we're all kind of racist. I mean, God put us all these different types down. It is interesting that I don't know what the... You know, the categories, it used to be Negroid, Caucasian, and like that. But I didn't really know any Chinese people. So I loved all this, and I became fascinated by their faces, and I just fell in love with the whole thing. But I made some very fast decisions. One is not to travel in China, but just to stay in one area. And I made 6 trips to the same small part of China, which is actually kind of a shithole. Has 35, 40 million people. It's incredibly polluted. And I liked it there. I liked it there because it reminded me of growing up in Queens in the 50s and Metropolitan Avenue, where we had trolleys and smoky cars and bicycles.
And so, how did you... I mean, so many of your books, I feel like, are very much about the relationship that you develop with the people you meet,
well,
and one feels that so much from the pictures. How did you develop with relationships with people where you didn't have even close to a common language?
Yeah, I couldn't understand anything. You know, it's a blessing, because when you talk to people, you can't photograph them. You want them to talk to someone else. So I developed a relationship with this one young Chinese girl I traveled with named Lollipop. She said, my name's Lollipop. I said, nobody's named Lollipop. And she changed it to Lolly, and Lolly became my companion and translator, and we traveled around together. Well, you know, it's about bookmaking. The term deep sea diver is actually a story of James Joyce and his mentally ill daughter meeting Jung, and Joyce telling Jung, you know, my daughter, I do all these things my daughter does. How come she's crazy? I'm not crazy. I talk like her. And his daughter was, in fact, psychotic. And Jung said to Joyce, well, you're a deep sea diver, and your daughter's drowning. So deep sea dive is actually about the anxiety I went through going from hearth and home, American turkeys, to these shitty hotels and traveling around and not being able to speak the language and not being of the same race, because it's very stressful. So it's a story and it's a picture and it's fun to read and it's beautiful and you get to keep it and it won't fall apart and you can give it to your grandchildren. Of course, it costs $200. Fiden publishes it. They have a website with all my new books are on the Fiden website. And
Fiden is at phaidon.com. And that's your publisher for this book.
And that one you were reading. Those are a collection of essays going back to the 60s.
Right. And that's a fascinating book, Memories of Myself. It's essays that include photographs and texts and draw on a lot of as you say, you're kind of a historian. You don't throw things out. You're a documentarian. So there's real source materials in there, the pictures and some of the text as well.
One of those essays, which no one would publish, is about black transvestites in Galveston in 1967.
I know. That was amazing.
And it's an amazing story. And this girl talks about, you know, we would consider it rape by her uncle, and she said it was the best experience she ever had, you know. And it's an amazing, dramatic, and graphic description of sex.
Well, much more to talk about, and I hope we do get a chance to talk again, because so many stories need to be told, and I think you said it very well, which is that we tend to do so much revisionist history, and it's important to remember how things were, especially in the context of the current movements, like this new Occupy movement.
I've been downtown 4 or 5 times. I spoke to the first time. It's a great experience. I urge everyone to go down there. You can go down around 6 o'clock. They're allowed there from 5 on. You can stand on the sidewalk.
And Occupy Albuquerque.
Albuquerque, and people from Santa Fe have gone there. You can wave to the people on Central to go by. It's amazing how many people blow their horns. You know, for every person actually in the park, you get hundreds of cars that blow their horns and waves. So I could talk forever about it. But I spoke publicly at a meeting the other day, and it's actually chanting and goes back to the Greeks. It's pretty amazing. And they, at one point, they held hands, which is straight out of SNCC. But these people aren't SNCC. There's something that's happened in my future, and I think when you commented that they've absorbed all these things, I think you're seeing the fruition of 40 years of liberation in America that's emerged in our children.
Danny Lyon is a photographer, filmmaker, and writer, and author of many books, which you can find, as once again, at Fiden.com, and also TwinPalms.com, and the Twin Palms publisher is right downtown in Santa Fe at 54.5 East San Francisco Street. Danny, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much. I hope I can come back.
I hope so, too.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.